us for an oral argument. The students have been sent materials about the case that we are about to hear, and students may have met with not only their own faculty, but lawyers from the community to discuss the case. And the next phase of the program is hearing your oral arguments, but then they will meet with a justice of the Supreme Court at noon to discuss the procedures of the court, and you are all invited to join with the students at about noon. We've met the students. I'd like to introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes, and she is the justice with whom you'll meet at about noon, and you'll be joined by students from Wisconsin Rapids Lincoln High School. Seated next to Justice Sykes is Justice David, it's Justice Patrick Crooks today. Seated next to me on my left is Justice John Wilcox, and I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With the introductions made, I'll call the second case this morning, 01-1201, Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church and School of Freistadt versus Tower Insurance Company. And the presentations are as follows. We will first hear from Charles F. Smith from Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meagher, and in Chicago, representing Tower Insurance Company. We'll then hear from Robert Jaskulski for 15 minutes of Domnitz et al. From Milwaukee, representing Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church and School, and then 15 minutes from attorney Merrick R. Domnitz of the same law firm representing the same parties, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal from Mr. Smith. Is that correct? Fine. We'll first hear from Wisconsin attorney M. Christine Coles, who will introduce our non-resident, non-admitted attorney. Is that right? Counsel, if you take the microphone, please.
I am Chris Coles with Borgelt, Paul Peterson, Frauen, representing Tower Insurance Company, and I'd like to introduce you to attorney Smith, Charles Smith, who will be making argument on Tower's behalf.
Do you want to be admitted pro hac vici?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
Okay, you are admitted. That'll make you a lawyer in Wisconsin for about an hour.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it, and I appreciate the privilege of practicing before this court this morning. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Charles Smith, and I represent the defendant in this case, Tower Insurance Company. The primary issue on this appeal by Tower is whether the appellate court erred in splitting the baby, in basically remanding this case to the trial court for a trial on the issue of whether Tower committed bad faith, an issue that was never heard by the jury because the trial court had erroneously taken it out of the jury's hand on a summary judgment motion, sua sponte, summary judgment ruling. The court remanded that bad faith issue for trial, but held that if the trial court finds bad faith, then the punitive damage award from the first trial will be reinstated. We believe that that's an inappropriate result under Wisconsin law for three separate but related reasons. First of all, although partial remands are, of course, appropriate in many circumstances, the law of the state under the Leonard case and other cases is that it is inappropriate to do so where the remand, partial remand, will result in either confusion, inconvenience, or prejudice to the rights of any party. And here I want to pull back and start with common sense, because what happened here at the first trial is that the judge decided there was bad faith. The judge instructed the jury on the first day of the trial that there was bad faith, and what that bad faith was in the judge's view. Plaintiff's counsel did an excellent job of doing what any good plaintiff's counsel would do, and argued during the trial that the court has already found bad faith. And then the judge, in closing, reminded them that the court had found bad faith. So the issue...
I've not read the transcript, counsel, of the trial. Was evidence admitted with respect to bad faith, or was that all excluded and the only issue was damages?
The only issue was actually punitive damages, Your Honor, because compensatory damages, the amount of compensatory damages was stipulated.
But in order to establish that, didn't the jury have to hear what the evidence was supporting bad faith?
They heard the evidence on whether we had intentionally disregarded the plaintiff's rights, Your Honor. And there is some overlap on that. But they heard it with, in the back of their minds, the fact that the court had already told them there's bad faith here. What the plaintiffs suggest in their briefs, I believe, what Trinity suggests in its briefs, is that somehow that didn't taint the trial in any way, the fact that there was this erroneous summary judgment ruling. Well, my argument is, I'm sorry.
Maybe you could help us by giving us what are the elements of bad faith and what are the elements of the punitive damage claim. Then we'll know, or try and know, whether there's such an overlap that if there's a directed verdict in effect on one, it affects the other.
Your Honor, the element for punitive damages under Wisconsin law, they've admitted that there is no willfulness here, there is no malice here. So the element that Trinity was pressing was whether there was an intentional disregard of the plaintiff's rights.
All right. What were the elements of bad faith?
And for bad faith, they have to show that in handling their claim, we denied the claim in bad faith and without adequate investigation.
What does denied in bad faith mean?
What does denied in bad faith mean? It means either intentionally denying it for an improper purpose or denying it without adequate investigation.
Is there a state of mind element?
There is a state of mind element for bad faith, and the state of mind for bad faith is intent or recklessness. For punitive damages, it is intentional disregard. And so it is a higher threshold for punitive damages. I'll get to that point later, but yes.
Now, are you going to argue, because opposing counsel has a cross appeal here, cross review, right?
Yes, they do, Your Honor.
And that the summary judgment for, they're arguing that the summary judgment on bad faith should be reinstated.
They are.
And if that summary judgment on bad faith is reinstated, then your argument that splitting it is false because...
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So are you going to argue that issue?
I am going to argue the cross appeal. I was going to leave that for third after I argued the issue splitting and the punitive damages issue. I was going to spend some time on the cross appeal and then let them argue and deal with it also in rebuttal. But I could deal with it first.
I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
Are you done, Chief? If you should prevail and it goes back for new trial, what evidence will you put in before the jury that either you were precluded from putting in or didn't put in because the only issue was damages?
I think that
additional evidence that the jury hasn't heard yet.
I think that there will be... It's a function of considering additional evidence, which may include expert testimony, but it also is a function of the verdict.
Asking for specifics, counsel. What specific evidence are you going to put in that you haven't already put in or that the jury hasn't heard?
We intend to offer expert testimony at the trial on bad faith, Your Honor. That expert testimony doesn't go to intent, obviously, but it goes to what standard conduct was and whether this was reasonable conduct under the circumstances. And when we get to the point of responding to why this summary judgment was inappropriate, I can address that issue. But I think it is important to note that what happened here is not a jury that with a blank slate decided that we had committed intentional wrongdoing. They decided that having been instructed that we committed bad faith. And that's the point under Leonard, which says that you can't have a partial remand where there is going to be prejudice. We can all speculate as to whether or not there was prejudice, but common sense tells us that if you're instructing a jury that there's bad faith and that the court has found bad faith, you have gotten them part of the way there to finding punitive damages.
Well,
and that's enough.
In an ordinary trial, they would have been asked to find bad faith, right?
That is correct.
And then they would have been asked about the second factor, namely punitive damages.
That is right.
So they will have already found bad faith. So what difference does it make whether they're told there's bad faith or they find bad faith? They still have to make a separate determination.
That is correct, Your Honor. But we would have the chance to prove our case on bad faith without the taint of the court and the plaintiffs, court stating and the plaintiffs arguing that the court's already taken that from us. That the court's already found it, that somehow, as a matter of law, Tower committed bad faith here. And your only question, jury, is how much to sock it to them and whether to sock it to them with punitive damages. And that is the prejudice that Tower suffered here. That is also, I believe, the kind of splitting of, although it's a remand, and I understand there's a state law permitting split remands, is the kind of concern that drives Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution and this Court's opinion in Waters. Because in what happened here is it's not your typical remand where you have tried the entire case to a jury and then it goes up on appeal and there is a partial remand of part of that case. Here, what happened is we never had the chance to try our bad faith case to the jury. We are just asking for that opportunity. And the standard practice in this state, as I understand it from looking at cases for the last 50 years, is that if there is a remand on liability, and if the appeal raises issues regarding damages, then regardless of the disposition of those issues by the appellate court, the damages issues should be remanded. I suggest to the court that is particularly the case here where A, it involves a matter of punitive damages, and B, where the trial was so infected by the bad faith finding. Excuse me one moment.
Well, counsel, one of the issues, and it's raised by your response to Justice Babich, is that you never made an offer of proof about what these experts were going to testify to, and you're not telling us what they testified to here now. And how do we know that they'd be any good?
Well, Your Honor, that is to some extent a fair point and to some extent not. At the trial level, as I understand it, the timetable was such that the court sua sponte granted summary judgment within 3 or 4 weeks after the parties had initially identified their experts. So so full expert opinions weren't formulated. This was done prior to full expert discovery having taken place and without an opportunity for Tower to respond because the court did it sua sponte. The court reached out in responding. Tower had a motion for summary judgment on legal issues, and the court reached out and granted summary judgment for Trinity. At a time, by the way, the Trinity had told the court, and this is in Record 101 at page 19, quote, it is the role of the jury to determine the facts surrounding Tower's knowledge at the time of a denial, not the court in a motion for summary judgment. What Tower's trying to do here
ordinarily, I'd agree with you. Ordinarily, the state of mind is a fact issue, and it's disputed, and summary judgment doesn't generally apply, just like it generally doesn't apply in a negligence case. But where there are facts that only one reasonable inference can be drawn, then there is no dispute of fact, and as a matter of law, summary judgment can be granted. Do you agree with that statement?
I agree with that entirely, Your Honor, and that is not this case.
Well, that's where
then
there's
why don't
a dispute, right?
Then why don't I turn to that issue, and then I'll come back to the punitives issue. Because that is where there's a dispute. What happened in this case is that Tower was faced with a set of facts. When it gets a call from its agent saying, gee, there's been a horrible accident, and by the way, I made a mistake in the coverage. They get that call. Trinity keeps saying over and over again there was no investigation here. That's just not right. They looked at the file. There was an application in the file that, in fact, did not include this coverage. There was no binder in the file. There was a renewal repeatedly by Trinity of this policy without this coverage. So they have an agent after an accident saying, gee, I made a mistake. There should have been this coverage, and there's not. And by the way, there's a big accident that would be covered by this. I want you to backdate the policy. He never used the word reformation. He used the word backdating. And he had errors and omissions coverage that would cover this kind of claim. Tower.
How much?
How much coverage? I don't know the dollar amount, but I recall that it was enough to cover more than $500,000.
They know that when they just said no?
Did they know that when they said no? I don't know that question was asked of Mr. Gallagher. I don't recall that. I'll ask Ms. Coles, and if we can find out, I'll address it in rebuttal.
Didn't that file also contain not an admission, but a statement by the person that Mr. Rodrigo reported to that he also knew that there was a mistake?
No, Your Honor. That was found later. What happened is in the course of the discovery and the dispute between Tower and Trinity and Utica, his insurer, it turned out that Rodrian had obtained a statement from this former employee, Harold Fisher, I believe is his name, saying that I recall that Rodrian asked for this coverage. When Tower was made aware of that statement, Tower reformed the policy. That's why, to me, this is an odd bad faith case, because what happened here is there's a reformation claim, which we're entitled to a judicial determination of under Wisconsin law. That's what the Tribble case that they cite says. We're entitled to a judicial determination of reformation. We don't have to have an agent say, gee, backdate this policy and just backdate every policy. Otherwise, we'd be backdating every policy. So we have that issue come up, and we seek a judicial determination on that issue. We do so, we're reserving our rights, but we're providing a defense to Trinity so that they're never without a defense. This is a coverage dispute between two carriers, in essence. And as soon as we find evidence, which Rodrian presented evidence of this, or they uncovered Rodrian's discussions with Fisher, and Fisher had this statement, when we find that out, we do the right thing. We reform the policy, we pay the claim, end of story. And we pay $17,000 in legal fees, which are the legal fees that they incurred in the coverage dispute. And somehow that turns into a $3.5 million punitive damage claim based on a summary judgment for bad faith. So do I think there's a trial issue for bad faith? I sure do. And I think that there's not a single Wisconsin case prior to this one that held that an insurer has a duty to reform a policy prior to a judicial declaration that it ought to be reformed. That kind of turns the law on its head a little bit.
How long was it from the time Mr. Rodino made this report that that he had made a mistake and the time that Mr. Fisher got involved?
I don't know the date that he obtained the statement from Mr. Fisher. That came up in the course of the coverage litigation, so there was a lapse in time. There was a period in time when Trinity didn't know who was going to be paying its claim. I don't dispute that. I also don't dispute, by the way, and I want to be clear on this. I'm not here to say that Gene Gallagher did everything right, because clearly he didn't. He should have done some other things beyond what he did.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment,
okay.
May we? Did he speak to any of the parties involved in the transaction?
He spoke to Mr. Rovery, and he did not speak to the insured.
He spoke to Mr. Rovery, and he told him that he'd made a mistake. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right.
And he never went back to look and see and check the mistake?
He checked the files, their records of the written transactions.
Okay. Did he seek the advice of counsel?
He did not seek the advice of counsel.
Right. He just denied coverage to his agent. Told him that that was it, right?
He denied coverage, that is correct.
So there was no investigation other than the paper files?
There was an investigation through the paper files, but there was no investigation beyond that.
And the information he got was that the paper files were not correct, that they did not include the meeting of the minds. That's the information he had. And he did nothing other than look again at the papers and then denied it. Isn't that what he did?
That is, in essence, what he did.
Within 48 hours.
That is what he did. That is correct.
And did he ever testify that that's his usual practice of handling claims?
He did testify that that is his usual practice of handling claims where there's an error by the agent that the agent says is an error, and there's errors and omissions coverage.
So he automatically denies it.
And that is one of his, that is what I would say was a mistake on his part. But he didn't have reason to...
You're saying mistake, but do you view it as a reckless disregard of what the insured has paid premiums for?
No, I do not, Your Honor.
There's a difference.
That's where there's a difference.
And who determines whether these facts are or are not reckless disregard?
That's an issue for the jury. All we are asking for here is to go before a jury and have the jury decide. And I want the jury to hear Gene Gallagher talk about this and talk about, because he had concerns about, right or wrong, he had concerns about Rotarian's veracity. And I'm not saying that those concerns are right, because in this situation, it turns out Rotarian was apparently telling the truth.
But he didn't investigate those concerns either.
He did not investigate further. What he did was...
He denied it.
He denied it, and that started the process that led to a declaratory judgment action, litigation between Rotarian and the company, where the court found that Rotarian was not entitled to indemnification from the company.
That's about the agency agreement.
Mm-hmm. And it resulted in litigation between Tower and Trinity, which was before the same judge, by the way. Trinity says somehow that we misled the court because we didn't raise the fact that there was this dispute with Rotarian in our summary judgment papers.
Yeah.
That was before the same judge the dispute with Mr. Rotarian.
Mr. Rotarian did make an investigation, didn't he?
I didn't hear the question,
Callan. That there was an investigation by the agent. Yes, to find out what exactly was the truth about whether Trinity did or didn't want this insurance coverage, right?
He certainly talked to Harold Fisher, who is the person he recalled talking to at the time, the underwriter.
And then how many weeks or months after the denial of this claim?
I don't recall the time period that lasted.
Quite short.
But it was pretty short, that's right.
Right, short. And did he spend a lot of money doing that, or isn't that part of the record?
He did not. I mean, I don't think he spent a lot of money doing that. It's not part of the record, but it...
Doesn't sound like he spent a lot of time either having to do it.
That's probably right. And should Gene Gallagher have... Did Gene Gallagher make a mistake in not reaching out to this former employee and trying to track him down and doing this... I would say Gene Gallagher made a mistake. In hindsight, if he'd done that, we would have reformed the policy earlier. We would have agreed to reform the policy earlier.
And who should bear the responsibility of that mistake? Tower or Trinity?
Nobody bears the responsibility because we did bear the responsibility in the sense that we've paid $17,000 in legal fees. But the responsibility, like many mistakes in life, there's not a judicial remedy for every one of them. And this is a mistake that was corrected, and corrected before any real harm had been suffered. It was corrected before litigation was on file against Trinity. Well, litigation was on file, but there hadn't been a judgment. And we corrected it, and we tendered a defense in the meantime, and we paid the judgment. That's why it's a mistake, but it's not bad faith. And it seems to me whether it's bad faith is an issue for a jury. It was not an issue for the trial court to take out of the jury's hand sua sponte. And it certainly wasn't an issue where they could do that, then instruct the jury that we found bad faith and go forth and decide whether to tag Tower Insurance with punitive damages.
I'm struck here. You make it sound so essentially not, maybe not innocent, but it was just a mistake. And, you know, I can buy that from the cold record, but then I look at the jury verdict, and these are 12 citizens, and they obviously were very offended.
I think that is fair.
$8.5 million worth of offense. What was it that made them so offended? What was so unreasonable about their being offended, in your judgment? This is $3.5 million.
This is speculation, but I'll give you my speculation. This is a case brought by a church that went to trial the week before Christmas 2 years ago on the issue of punitive damages. It is a case where there was some evidence that Gallagher acted out of economic motives, that he acted because he knew there was a big claim on the horizon, and that he was going to deny this and force the fight with Utica over who should pay that big claim. And that was offensive to the jury, if I had to guess. And we might lose a trial on bad faith because of that sort of evidence, because the jury might believe that he acted entirely out of an economic interest, as opposed to, you know, his explanations for why he did what he did. But I think we're entitled to that trial. And that's all we are seeking. And that's what the Court of Appeals agreed to give us. And not simply because Trinity said in their trial brief that that was a factual issue for the jury. They did say that in the trial court, and they ought to be bound by that. But because the court looked at the facts and said, look, the issue of Gallagher's mental state here is one that is subject to dispute. And that is at the heart of a bad faith claim. So we need to have a jury trial on the bad faith claim.
Mr. Smith, you're going to have to address why Judge Becker's motion on summary judgment or her ruling on summary judgment was wrong.
That's right. It was wrong because she granted summary judgment on an issue of mental state at a time when there was conflicting evidence on that issue. And material conflicts of evidence on that issue.
What were they?
They were whether Gene Gallagher acted out of an improper motive in denying the claim, or whether he acted out of either mere negligence in denying the claim, or with a proper motive and merely out of negligence. And that is an issue that's for the trier of fact. It is not an issue that was for the judge. And Judge Becker took that away from the jury, sua sponte, on summary judgment. And, you know, clearly there are actions here that Mr. Gallagher took that people have found offensive, to use one of the justice's words. Whether a jury of 12 or 6, knowing all of the facts and not having been instructed that Tower committed bad faith, would find that, in fact, this was bad faith claims handling, is, I submit, an issue that should be decided by that jury. That's why summary judgment was improper here, because, as the Chief Justice pointed out, typically mental state is not a subject for summary judgment.
Counsel, you had a situation here within 48 hours, just looking at a relatively empty file, of just papers of insurance policies. You have no investigation by the insurance company other than they fear a claim. And that's what you pay premiums to them, to pay claims. They do nothing. You've got an agent who goes out and investigates it and finds that he's right. The company, which I assume has more resources than this agent, still sits on its hands, How long does it take before the company pays this claim?
The company paid the claim when there was actually a claim. I mean, that's...
How long did it take before the company agreed that there was coverage here?
I don't recall the exact lapse in time, but there was a significant lapse in time.
Significant lapse in time. Until they got a deposition.
It was until they got, yes, investigation materials that showed, and the investigation, by the way, was from Rondrian's carrier, his E&O carrier.
Not your client. The client still hasn't investigated. It now finds out from someone else who's investigated. Is that right?
Our client had done some investigation, didn't find evidence to support what Rondrian was saying. Rondrian's carrier, which had an economic incentive to find such evidence, went out and found that evidence.
Well, your client had an economic interest to find the evidence, too?
All parties had an economic interest to find the evidence.
Your client, nothing.
Did nothing beyond what I've said he did. I don't think it's fair to say
she knows. 48 hours.
That is correct. Well, and then they filed a declaratory judgment action, and they sought, and there was discovery, and this matter was litigated to the point where people got discovery and found out the facts, and Tower quickly then reformed the policy.
Isn't it fair to say that Tower, within 24 hours, concluded that its own agent was lying to them?
Concluded that there was a risk that its own agent was lying to it.
Risk?
Was what?
That there was a risk that its own agent was lying to it.
By denying the claim, isn't that...
It was a risk that the agent was lying.
Yes.
It sounds to me like it had to be a conclusion, because they denied the claim.
But recall, the issue of reformation is one for the court. The policy, they could deny the claim based on the policy and then seek a judicial declaration of whether that policy should be reformed, or Trinity actually should seek the declaration of whether that policy should be reformed. That didn't happen. Ultimately, the issue of reformation came up through all the morass of legal proceedings, and we reformed the policy. But we are entitled to, we as an insurance carrier has to have the right to insist on a judicial declaration when it comes to reformation. Because otherwise, agents always have the incentive to make the client happy by saying, I should have included this. I should have included that. When an accident comes that's not within the coverage on the face of the policy, a policy application that the client had, the customer had, policy form that they had, and they renewed that policy year after year without this coverage.
Mr. Smith, you remember the note that Mr. Gallagher wrote to Carol Blackwell.
I remember it all too well, Your Honor.
All right. Your referral says that this agency error, not ours, we didn't get requests to provide such and such as, didn't get copy of binder till now.
We did not get a copy of the binder.
Yeah. Well, that means within 48 hours you had a document that was a copy of the document that was given to the client, and it checked the boxes. I mean, with all due respect, there's a lot of good arguments I think you're making, but to turn on Mr. Rondrian and say that he was not telling the truth to the company, I don't think that's a good argument in view of this note.
Mr. Gallagher testified that it was his belief that he had concerns about Mr. Rondrian's veracity, and that is part of why Mr. Gallagher took the actions that he took. I understand that the binder came eventually from Rondrian, not from the policyholder. There is no... Trinity did not know that this was a binder that had been given, Tower did not know that this was a binder that had been given to Trinity, as I understand it.
You're suggesting that Tower thought that its agent had fabricated a binder?
Tower had concerns about whether its agent was trying to create coverage where there was none. That is correct. In order to provide coverage to a valued insured of a good claim that was not covered under the insurance policy. And that kind of dispute is why reformation ought to be the subject of litigation, not some sort of obligation outside of litigation that then creates a bad faith finding. That's part of what Tower has argued all along in this case. It's why Tower filed the motions it filed back in the trial court, was to try to say, reformation's an issue for judicial determination. Let's get it before a court, and let's get a judicial determination of this issue. And then they promptly, prior to Trinity getting hit with any claim, paid or agreed to cover Trinity, and paid $490,000 to cover this claim, and now have paid $17,000 roughly to cover the legal fees. My point on that, going back to it, is that that's an issue that we can all pick and choose pieces of the record, and you know, I'm doing that, and they'll stand up and do that, but my point on that is that's an issue that should have gone to the jury to decide in the first instance.
And you filed a declaratory judgment before your client did any investigation?
Any investigation beyond what the client had already done.
Filed. Okay. Thank you.
Let's.
Your red light is on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You have 5 minutes in the rebuttal. Mr. Jaskolski.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This appeal really deals with two different issues, and I want to address one of them at the outset, which really concerns the cross appeal that has been filed by Trinity in this case. The cross appeal really focuses on the trial court's summary judgment determination. And I think it is a prelude to any discussion that is had regarding the punitive damage verdict or the decision on remand of the trial court or the appellate court. Consequently, with the court's indulgence, I want to get right into the summary judgment determination by the trial court. In this case, there are certain key facts that were undisputed at the time the trial court decided summary judgment. They were undisputed when this case was tried to a jury, and they remain undisputed today. These are the facts of this case. And there are basically, in my view, essentially six important facts that warrant affirmance of the trial court summary judgment determination. First, the error in this insurance policy was made by Jim Rodrian, who at the time was an agent pursuant to a written agency contract with this insurance carrier. Secondly, at the time Mr. Gallagher denied coverage to Trinity, he was aware that the policy was in error because of Mr. Rodrian's mistake. In response to Justice Prosser's question regarding the content of that note by Mr. Gallagher, I am amazed at the fact that Tower now stands before this court and takes the position that at the time of the denial, they denied coverage because they suspected that Mr. Rodrian was not telling the truth. All one needs to do is review Mr. Rodrian's note that is part of this record, generated at the time of denial, in which he identifies it as an agency error. This is our agent's error. There's no question regarding the press. Mr. Gallagher, in his specific note denying coverage, identifies this as an agency error. If it weren't an agent's, if this were an issue of Mr. Rodrian,
maybe he was being kind. Maybe he was, didn't want to come right out and accuse Rodino of lying, but so he said it was an error.
The reality of the facts of this case is there has never been introduced evidence, whether it be at the summary judgment proceedings or at the time of trial, that the mistake in this policy was anything but a clerical error by Mr. Rodrian. The only evidence that they can introduce is the fact that they now state it. But that's not enough to create a genuine issue of material fact.
Well, if it's an agent's error, isn't the company bound anyway? Isn't the company bound by an agent's error?
That is the key determining fact in how this claim should have been handled. Because in addition, when they understood that it was an agency error, agency law in the state of Wisconsin is very clear. Mr. Rodrian is, in effect, Tower Insurance Company. Mr. Rodrian's error is their error. Despite knowledge of that fact, Tower proceeded to deny coverage, and they conducted no meaningful investigation of this claim.
Is that your third fact?
That is the third fact. Fourth, that the denial by Tower was motivated in part by what Tower perceived as the potential for a big dollar loss if they paid the claim. It's right in Mr. Gallagher's note. Fifth, Tower denied coverage here despite knowing, and I think this is a fact of critical importance, despite knowing of its obligations to reform this contract because Tower was the named defendant in the seminal case in the state of Wisconsin that defines when reformation is in order, Tribal versus Tower Insurance Company. They must be held accountable for subjective knowledge of the holding in the Tribal case. They were the defendant in that case. And lastly, the sixth fact, armed with all this knowledge, armed with knowledge of an undisputed mutual mistake of fact, armed with knowledge of Tribal versus Tower Insurance Company, armed with all this knowledge, Tower not only denies coverage to their insureds, they bring a motion for summary judgment in front of a trial court where they submit an affidavit attaching a policy that they represent as an officer of the court that this is the insurance contract, and they request a declaratory judgment avoiding coverage without saying a word to the trial court about the mistake. Mr. Smith is wrong when he represents to this court that the trial court at that time had knowledge of the issue associated with Rodrian. This motion was brought within weeks of the institution of the action, months before any issue was brought before the trial court.
Did they know about Fisher's statement at the time they brought that action?
They did not know about Fisher's statement at the time they brought the action. Fisher's statement comes to light later on. Once the motion for summary judgment is filed, the church, who is unrepresented on the coverage issue at the time, hires Attorney Holtz to represent their interests on the issue of coverage. It is Attorney Holtz who notices up the underwriter's deposition. And in the deposition, Mr. Fisher indicates that at the deposition, this is the first time anyone from Tower Insurance has ever approached him to ask him his version of the circumstances of this claim. The agent's E&O carrier had done it, but up until this point in time, only at the behest of Trinity, does Tower make an inquiry regarding exactly what happened here. These undisputed facts have been evaluated by the trial court in summary judgment. They have been evaluated by a jury at trial and on appeal from the District 2 Court of Appeals. Each time, the body that has reviewed these facts has found that this insurance company acted in a disregard of the rights of the insured. Now, the trial court found that disregard to be reckless. The jury found it to be intentional. Regardless, based on the undisputed facts in this case, the trial court got it right when it determined that there was no issue for trial before the jury.
Was the jury instructed on that, that they, in order to find punitive damages, they had to find intentional?
Yes. In fact, the trial court was very careful to explain to the jury not only the standard for punitive damages and the issue before the jury, which was intentional disregard. The court also didn't just say to them, we find bad faith. The court defined for this jury specifically the difference between bad faith and intentional disregard by reading to the jury the instruction on bad faith. Counsel's argument assumes that this jury somehow didn't understand the instructions or chose to disregard those instructions. And I don't believe that that is a basis upon which one can challenge the jury's findings in this case. With regard to the summary judgment determination of the trial court, I think it is an important fact, a critical fact in this case, that the record for summary judgment was placed before the court, not by Trinity, but by Tower. Tower is the entity that requested summary judgment from this trial court. And when a party moves for summary judgment, it is an explicit assertion by the moving party that the facts are ripe for a determination as a matter of law. And when a party moves for summary judgment, that party cannot later claim that it's entitled to a jury trial that it previously claimed was unnecessary. That's exactly what Tower does now standing before this court. Tower's request for summary judgment in this case, in addition, was not based just on legal issues. They put before, specifically before the court, the factual issues associated with their conduct. What I find to be amazing is that they argue that they did not do that in summary judgment. Yet on pages 8 and 9 of their appellate brief in this case, in response to our cross appeal, they asked this court to make a determination that they did not act in bad faith. It is when they stand before a court and they request that determination on the basis of their conduct, this court must make that decision on the basis of the record before it. The idea that they can now come and represent that there is expert testimony that needs to be considered without defining for that court what expert testimony they intend to introduce, providing a decent offer of proof, I believe is improper under these circumstances. Now,
could I ask you a question?
Yes, Justice.
Was Mr. Rodrian negligent?
I believe Mr. Rodrian would have been found negligent for his conduct in this case, yes.
And in what respect?
Because Mr. Rodrian clearly had a request from an insured, Trinity, and there was no dispute about this, that they wanted hired and non-owned vehicle coverage in their policy. He went to his application. There was a change in forms. They used to have a box that you checked. Now they changed the structure of the form. He didn't notice the change in the form, and he didn't. There was now I think it used to be no box. Now there was a box he had to check. He didn't check the box. I think an argument could be made that constitutes a failure to exercise reasonable care on the part of the agent.
Was there any other negligence on his part?
I don't believe so, Justice Brosnan.
He didn't send a copy of the binder to his insurance company.
Well, there is an issue of dispute with regard to whether he did or did not send that binder to the insurance company. Mr. Rodrian claimed that he did send the binder to the insurance company. The insurance company searched the file and determined that there was no binder in the file at the time.
There was a dispute between Rodrian and Tower about indemnification.
Correct.
Why didn't the Court of Appeals ever mention that?
Because I think ultimately the dispute between Rodrian and Tower is an issue that is not of relevance in determining whether an insurance carrier has exercised its duty of good faith and fair dealing. It's a separate and independent determination. That's why I don't believe it's a reasonable basis for an insurance carrier to deny coverage based on the fact that there's E&O coverage. In fact, I believe our law recognizes the fact that it's an irrelevant determination based on the operation of the Unfair Claims Practice Act. You cannot ignore your duty of good faith and fair dealing to the insured based on the potential that some third party, whether it be an insurer or otherwise, may be liable for the claim. When the claim is advanced, a request for coverage under the policy, as this court determined in Danner versus Auto Owners, the obligation of the insurance company from the inception is to investigate the claim, subject the result.
Review, and if coverage is required, you must provide coverage. Reformation is just like any other insurance contract dispute. Consequently, I don't see that those issues, and I believe that's why the Court of Appeals didn't get into it, are relevant to the bad faith issues currently before the court.
And you have a bad faith claim without damages?
I believe under certain circumstances you can have a bad faith claim without damages if there is potential harm to the insured. And I think it's of critical importance that that be allowed in bad faith cases just like this, because if the courts don't take into consideration the potential harm, you'll run into a situation in which the insurance company's sole exposure is minimal because of the lack of actual damages. All they have to do is stand back and wait for the insurance care, the insured, to identify the problem and request coverage. They can just throw up their hands then, provide the coverage as they did in this case, and walk away from their duty of good faith and fair dealing because there may be no damages. It's potential harm, I think, that's the key. And I think it's the key to affirming the punitive damages in this case also. But Mr. Domlitz is going to address those issues in detail.
When was bad faith claim, the earliest time that the bad faith claim was complete?
The earliest time it was complete, I believe the essence of bad faith occurred at the time of denial. At the time that Mr. Gallagher issued that note and issued a directive to the company that they should deny the claim. But I believe it continued from that point forward. Because in my view, the bad faith is represented not only by, number one, first off, there's an objective finding in bad faith and a subjective element. The objective element is, was there a reasonable basis for the denial of the claim? I believe that the tribal case deals with that issue when there's no dispute of fact on the existence of the mutual mistake. Now the question becomes, it's not an issue of, and I think opposing counsel indicated you have to have improper motive in order to prove bad faith. That is not the law in the state of Wisconsin. The second element does not require subjective improper motive. All it requires is subjective knowledge that there's no reasonable basis for the claim. Why need this court go any further than the case of Treble versus Tower Insurance Company? They must be charged with subjective knowledge in this case of the law. That's as far as you need to go. That establishes bad faith there. But in this case, the bad faith continued. Because in addition to subjective knowledge, they conducted no reasonable investigation of this claim at all. None. They did not talk to this underwriter until years after the claim. Counter to counsel's representations, there was no conversations between Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Rodrian. The fact of the matter is, you had three principals involved in this transaction, none of whom were accessed or spoken to by the representative who made this decision. Worst off, because bad faith can continue, and it did in this case, in light of this court's decision in Tribal, the determination of the defense in this case at the inception of the litigation to approach the trial court and request summary judgment, I believe is the most egregious aspect of the defendant's conduct here. It knew this insurance policy was wrong. It is the essence of bad faith for them to have come before the trial court and essentially misrepresent the status of the contract with their insured. I cannot characterize it any better than it was characterized by the Court of Appeals in this case. And that is, and I quote, Tower's decision to send its attorney to the court and ask for summary judgment without ever informing the court of the dispute regarding Rodrian's error and request for backdating shows blatant disregard for its insured in this court. That motion alone is support for the court's conclusion of bad faith.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. You'll now hear from Mr. Domnitz.
Good morning, Justices. I want to commend the court because I have all kinds of notes here, and you hit on just about all of them with your questions. But I do want to, it was my designated role in this case is to talk about the punitive damage verdict and why we think that it should be upheld, as it was by the appellate court, of course. I think that Mr. Jaskolski touched on the basic point with regard to the punitive damages, and that is that the key here to the punitives being reasonable is this concept of potential harm. And Mr. Jaskolski touched on the fact that were this court to issue a ruling that somehow indicated that the punitive damages are, as Tower urges, unreasonable because they represent a 200-to-1 ratio. That is the ratio between the $17,000 in attorney's fees and the $3.5 million award by the jury. Were you to issue a ruling here that indicated that that's the true measure of punitive damages, I submit to this court that you would create a tear in the fabric of insurance contractual law in Wisconsin that companies like Tower would try to drive a locomotive through.
Mr. Donitz,
yes, sir.
Let me frame it a little bit differently, in very much the same way I framed it to your opposing counsel. Looking at this record, I somewhat with an open mouth, sort of, $3.5 million as punitive damages where there seems to be essentially very little harm. I mean, it dragged things out, and I'm sure it got Trinity worried, et cetera, but even those were eventually taken care of. So 3.5 just hits me right between the eyes. But then my second thought is, yeah, but this is a jury that, good citizens, and I greatly respect the jury system. Why, in your judgment, did they come up with, at least to me, is an astounding figure?
I think they did justice for exactly the reason that you mentioned in your first question to Mr. Smith. The jury here clearly found the conduct of Tower to be so reprehensible, to grab the word from the BMW case from the U.S. Supreme Court, to be so egregious, to grab the word out of our own jury instruction, that they found the $3.5 million was the appropriate amount of money. And I believe that they did so because they looked right at our jury instruction. This was a very attentive jury. They looked right at jury instruction 1707.1, which says to the jury, when you're deciding what amount, if any, is appropriate for punitive damages, you're to look at, and I have the quote here in my notes, the potential damage which might have been done by such acts, as well as the actual damage. And the interesting thing is that the instruction doesn't tell the jury that they may consider the potential harm. It tells the jury that they should consider the potential harm. And the reason that it does that is exactly what Mr. Jaskolski mentioned before. If this court were to indicate to insurance companies that their exposure on bad faith to behavior that is in abrogation of their duty of good faith and fair dealing to their own insureds, if their exposure is going to be defined by some multiple of the money that it takes to extricate oneself from the situation that the insurance company creates, for example, the $17,000 in fees, you will create a situation in which insurance companies can make an actuarial decision. They can do a risk-benefit analysis, and they can determine when, on a large insurance policy, it just might be worth their time to turn their back on their insured and take a shot that maybe something like the written policy doesn't provide for hired and non-owned vehicle coverage, it just might fly. I'll quote you a recent movie that came out recently. A movie said they were just inches from a clean getaway, and that's what happened here. Had the church not pooled their resources and decided to hire their own lawyer at their own expense of $17,000 worth of attorney's fees, this company would have did in fact stand in front of the court and say to that court, we're entitled to summary judgment because, look, here's the policy, and it says there's no hired and non-owned vehicle coverage. And they did that more than a year after their own agent said to them, look, the policy document is erroneous. I made a mistake. I bound this coverage with the insured, and I sent them a copy of the binder, and they've relied on having that coverage.
How long was this agent with the company?
It never came into the record how long, but I do know.
Is he still with them, or did they fire him?
I believe he is still with them. He testified at the trial. The interesting thing, of course, that I found is one of those little facts that always sticks in your mind. Jim Gallagher, the Mr. Gallagher from the record that you've read, is the signator to the agency contract of Jim Rodrian.
And he's still an agent.
I don't know. I can't represent to this court that he is. I do know that he had been an agent for them for a long time because Mr. Fisher, the underwriter for Pellet, said that based on my experience with Mr. Rodrian, he always asked for this kind of coverage.
I have another question for you. According to Mr. Gallagher, that was the company policy, deny it. Just deny the claim under these conditions.
He said it was his.
That's right. Were you able to get any discovery? Because I think most people, if the company says no, they're not going to cover, they don't have the wherewithal, either knowledge or finances, to continue on with this fight. So did you find out what percent just went home and went into bankruptcy or didn't go into bankruptcy?
We didn't. We typically are not. We don't meet with success when at the trial court level, in the absence of the later finding, we ask to expand the scope of discovery to other people. They consider their customer list to be proprietary in nature, and typically we're frustrated in trying to do that kind of discovery. I note with some interest that apparently the courts in Idaho feel a little differently about that, because in that case, or maybe it was Utah, I'm sorry, where the Campbell case is pending, in that case they allowed punitive damages based on things that happened all over the country. But in Wisconsin, my experience in handling bad faith cases over the last 2.5 decades is that trial courts tend not to let us expand the discovery beyond that. They're concerned on 90403 type considerations as to just which case we're going to try. But the answer to the question is we have no information on that.
So, counsel, this is just continuing a little bit on Justice Babich's question. The measurement of punitive damages, and we've listened to the argument here and we've read the briefs. So what if this was $35 million or $3.5 billion, would you be here saying the same thing?
No. No, I think that at some point the court has to be concerned with public policy and that there has to be some reasonable parameters by which to define what's a righteous award by a jury.
And what are they? What are the reasonable parameters?
I guess I feel a little bit like the Supreme Court Justice says, I don't know if I can define it, but I know it when I see it.
Right. Okay. Well, let's say it was...
Well, my response would be here. 7-1 is clearly, in light of the other cases that have been decided by this court in this state at both the appellate and Supreme Court level, well within the parameters of reasonableness.
Where do you get 7?
I'm sorry?
7-1. What are you concluding?
I'm taking the $490,000 settlement, the $17,000 in attorney's fees, adding them together for roughly $500,000 compared to the 3.5.
Because when your client went into this case, he had zero. He was getting zero from this company.
That's right.
And he left the case with over $500,000.
What he had in his pocket, Judge, and what he had the right to rely on was the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And the question is, what is the message that comes forth from this court in the face of this duty of good faith and fair dealing? How are we going to teach people like Tower Insurance, people that are also... who are similarly situated to this insurance company, that they cannot stonewall their insureds, that they cannot snub their nose at this court the way they did by ignoring the tribal case, that they cannot ignore the dictates of the Wisconsin legislature by conducting business in total disavowal of the Uniform Fair Claims Act. All of those things this company has done. That's why the Waukesha County jury, in less than 2 hours, found this conduct to be so reprehensible and so egregious. And now to return full circle to the very first question that Justice Babich asked, why did they do that? Why did this verdict come popping out of this Waukesha County jury? And on what facts? And the answer is on the exact same facts that they want to now go back to the trial court on and have another trial on bad faith. I put one line in the brief. The rest of it you can attribute to Mr. Jaskolski. I had one line in the brief, other than my signature. And that line was, their request for a new trial on bad faith is analogous to a person who has been convicted of murder asking to be returned to the trial court so that they can be tried on the battery count. That's essentially what we're talking about here. Please understand, there seemed to be some confusion about the construction of the verdict. Please understand that when the verdict was submitted to the jury, there was only just a punitive damage question on the verdict. They had to answer a factual question. Did the conduct of Tower Insurance rise to the level of an intentional disregard of the church's rights? If they answered that question no, they never got to the punitive damage question. They answered it yes, then they went to the punitive damage question. And Judge Hassan, a very experienced trial judge, went to great pains to make sure that the jury understood that we were not trying the bad faith action. You need not be concerned with the bad faith action. He instructed them on the difference between bad faith and intentional disregard, and he instructed them on the difference between compensatory damages and punitive damages. There are cases in Wisconsin that indicate, and foremost is the Birch case versus American Family Insurance, that says that the assumption of the court must be that a jury heard the court's instructions, understood the court's instructions, and followed the court's instructions.
Mr. Domnitz, what is the standard of review that you're urging us to apply in regard to the award of punitive damages?
I think the cases are clear that this court is to conduct a de novo review of the trial court's review of the punitive damages. I think that in no way indicates that this court is not to still be bound by the fact that by a search of the record for evidence that will support this verdict. And I think that to the extent that you find evidence in this verdict amongst the facts, for example, that Mr. Jaskolski indicated, and of course those facts must be viewed in a light most favorable to the verdict, I believe that then this verdict must be supported.
Is there anything in the record to indicate where they got the $3.5 million? Did they just pull it out of the air, or was there?
I think, you know, my view of it is that they simply gave a multiple of the $500,000 of potential harm. I mean, I think that they sure didn't struggle with it, Justice Bablich. I mean, it was less than 2 hours, you know, in what is in a county which is not, and how shall I phrase this, not exactly renowned for its for returning plaintiff's verdicts. By the way, one personal point here. Over and over again in their briefs, Tower Insurance has indicated that this is some sort of a record punitive damage award. That's a quote that they grabbed out of a newspaper by an irresponsible reporter who attributed the comment to me. I never said it, and I have no idea whether it's true or not. It has nothing to do with it, because I suppose that eventually someone's going to end up with the largest verdict in Waukesha County. But the point here is, to answer your question directly, it appears very obvious to me that based on the facts that we've put before this court today, this jury looked at a church that was put in harm's way to the tune of $500,000, and they simply gave an award which bore, in their mind, as the jury, a reasonable resemblance to the potential and actual harm, just as the jury instruction tells them to
do. Mr. Domnitz, let me make a little argument. You have voir dire in a jury trial so that the jury starts out with a blank slate, no biases, no knowledge about the case. I think it's Mr. Smith's argument that all of that voir dire and effort to secure completely open mind was destroyed here when the jury was instructed that the defendant is guilty of bad faith. That's already been determined. Could you address that?
I will, sir, yes. What happened here was that the jury was voir dired, and the fact that the court had found bad faith as a matter of law was fair game during voir dire, so that we were able to address that. It was brought to the jury's attention in a neutral fashion by a statement read by the court, such that counsel could deal with it on voir dire and make their exclusions from the jury appropriately.
Counsel, you're addressing in past responses the amount of damages and punitive damages, and of course my understanding of the law is one of the ways to arrive at amount is to consider the deterrent effect. Your opposing counsel notes on page 38 of its brief. As to specific deterrence of Tower, the record establishes that Tower is no longer in the insurance business. The company no longer sells or underwrites insurance, and at this point has no employees. Asked us to take judicial notice, I think, of the Office of Commissioner of Insurance. Can you respond to the deterrent effect argument?
Yes, Justice. We have supplemented this record with absolute proof from the Office of the Insurance Commissioner of the State of Wisconsin that Tower Insurance, although they have changed their name to Hawkeye Security Insurance, is a licensed insurer in the state of Wisconsin, that they are selling insurance and collecting premiums, okay? I believe in the last quarter before the papers we got, they had collected, I think, $38,000 worth of premiums. But they are licensed in Wisconsin, and they are selling insurance. I don't know whether they're selling insurance in Wisconsin, but they are licensed insurer in Wisconsin. They know that this case is still up on appeal. They're selling insurance elsewhere. They're taking in premiums elsewhere, and they're still licensed in Wisconsin.
Mr. Gallagher still employed by Hawkeye?
Last I heard, he was with Indiana, which was part of the corporate ladder of this thing, and all I can say is I hope not.
Did anyone ask the jury if they had seen Aaron Brockovich?
On Vordaer, I don't recall that question being asked. I don't recall that question being asked.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Boy, I have a lot to do in 5 minutes. Let me start with the last point that Justice Bradley raised. Hawkeye Insurance is a separate company from Tower Insurance. The parent companies, ultimately, these are all under Liberty Mutual. The parent company acquired a company called Hawkeye Insurance, oddly enough, from Iowa. And it had a license because it had dissolved Tower. It had a license in Wisconsin and was able to transfer that license and use it for Hawkeye. That is permissible under the Wisconsin's insurance regulations. The insurance department knew that was going on, and that's how it happened. Tower is no more. Tower has no employees. Tower writes no business. To answer someone else's question, Agent Rodrian is not writing business for Tower because Tower does not exist.
Who's going to pay this judgment?
If this judgment is not overturned in its entirety, or if we don't win at trial, this judgment will be paid. I will tell you that, because I am typically counsel for Liberty Mutual, that Liberty Mutual will ensure that this judgment is paid. I mean, that's my understanding.
Oh, because it's all part of one various holding company.
I believe so, and I believe that as insurers are dissolved, there are funds reserves that have to be kept in place for these issues. I do know that when the matter went up on appeal initially, we knew that Tower no longer existed, and that we had to make sure that that was going to be the case.
Have you substituted anybody for Tower?
No, because Tower was the company. There is no, and that's part of the point here. There's not a deterrent effect against Tower to focus on punitive
damages.
About
the whole Liberty, is it a deterrent effect on Liberty if they're going to pay?
I don't think it's legitimate, and there's a ton of case law actually on that point, which is you can't deter other companies. You can't look at deterrent effect on other companies just because
even
they're
within the
right,
same structure.
Right. You have to respect the corporate formalities to the extent the corporations do, and there's been no attempt in this
case. Are Tower's employees now Hawkeye's employees?
I believe not, Your Honor. I asked that question. It's odd because they could have raised this issue at trial and did not. They chose to raise it first in this court, and so we don't have an evidentiary record. But I did ask the question.
They chose to first raise it in this court. My reading of the briefs, and I try to read them in sequence, is that it first appeared in your brief that Tower was no longer doing business.
Yes, but we raised that issue in the trial court. Their response that Tower is in fact doing business was first raised in this court.
You're representing to this court on behalf of Tower Insurance or whoever owns. You're representing to this court in response to my question that Tower Insurance employees are not currently working for Hawkeye. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. And I did ask that question.
Or any other company under the Liberty umbrella?
There may be some tower employees who are working for other companies under the Liberty umbrella. That would not surprise me. When you dissolve a company, some of them may stay employed with other Liberty entities. But I don't know that one way or the other, Your Honor.
Counsel, am I correct in my premise that the primary issue, in addition to the amount of punitive damages during the trial, was the intent of Tower?
I think that's fair.
So if that's a correct statement, and the jury found that they did intend, that Tower intended this conduct, why do we have to send it back for another trial on the issue of whether or not Tower was reckless?
Because, Your Honor, they decided that, having been instructed, and I'll read just a portion of the instruction that they got. The instruction said that the court had found that Tower acted in bad faith in denying coverage, that based on Tower's failure to conduct an adequate investigation, the court found that Tower recklessly failed to ascertain that coverage to Trinity for the Erdman accident should have been provided. That was the starting point, and then counsel spends the trial arguing that. I don't think we got a level playing field trial on this issue, because as Justice Prosser pointed out, this was the voir dire that's designed to give us a clean slate couldn't give us a clean slate because of the summary judgment ruling. I do need to correct one thing. I did misstate something. I misstated that the Rotarian summary judgment motion was filed by Tower prior to the summary judgment motion against Trinity. Turns out that there were two Trinity summary judgment motions, one of which was before and one of which was after the Rotarian motion. So I needed to clarify that. I wanted to focus for a minute on punitives, if I have the time, on the astounding figure of punitives here. Under BMW versus Gore, the degree of reprehensibility here, this is purely economic harm. And we paid the claim. We reformed the policy. It seems to me that it is very difficult to argue that Tower should be on the hook for 200 times the attorney's fees that were incurred in the coverage dispute. I could go on for a lot longer, but the light has lit, and I want to thank the court for permitting me to argue this case and appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith and Mr. Jaskowski.